morning, witches. This is the Witch Daily Show with host Tanya Brown. We are coming to you from New Orleans, Louisiana, to offer you a bite-sized bit of magic. Our 20-minute-ish episodes are the perfect start to your day. So sit back, relax, and enjoy your pop of magic.
We have a special segment today, author, psychologist, and former chief of the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, Philip Cargum, will be joining us today to talk about the connections between witchcraft and druidry. So, hi, how are you today?
Hi, lovely to see you, Tanya. Yeah, great to be here.
Yay, we're so happy. Actually, one of our podcast listeners really wanted to have you on, so... We're super excited to have you today.
Great.
So before we kind of get into the connections between witchcraft and druidry, can you explain to our listeners who may be unfamiliar what druidry is?
Okay. So druidry is the spiritual tradition that grew up, thousands of years ago in the British Isles, Ireland, the western part of France, that sort of region, and which by the 6th century Christianity had really subsumed in some way, or repressed, or replaced, and it experienced a revival about 300 years ago, and then in the last 50 years or so, since the sounds a long time ago if you say the end of the last century, but of course that we're talking about the 1990s. In the sort of 1980s and 90s, as the environmental crisis kind of hit and people became more aware of that, and as people started turning to indigenous spiritualities, a whole wave of interest in druidry came about, and that's what we're witnessing today, really. So in some ways, it's a very modern spirituality that's responding to the needs of the time. It's like a kind of green religion, if you like, but it's drawing on inspiration from way back into the past.
So how would you connect that to modern witchcraft today? Are they in the same vein? Does modern witchcraft pull from druidry? How do you view that whole thing? Because witchcraft... is such a term right now that can mean so many different things.
Exactly. With all these things, it's a joke in the druid community, and it's probably a joke in the witchcraft community as well, that if you ask 10 druids for their opinion, you'll get 11 replies, you know. So I'm just speaking for myself, but I mean, modern druidry and Wicca certainly are were very much influenced in the 1950s, you know, depending, without going into a lot of detail about the history, they kind of evolved in the period, just after that, well, during the, say, in the 1940s, really, during the 30s. So you could say, I suppose, the middle of the 20th century. And there were two kind of seminal figures. They were male, but actually their female counterparts were equally, if not more, important. So you had Gerald Gardner with Doreen Valiente, who wrote a lot of the material that Wiccan still use today. And there was Ross Nichols, who was my spiritual teacher, who was a druid, and Vera Chapman, who was his kind of Doreen Valiente, if you like, who wrote a lot of the material too, who was an author and a poet as well. And they knew each other and they were friends. And when you study their characters, it's really rather interesting seeing how the way Wicca evolved and the way Druidry evolved are kind of reflect, you needed people with those characters to express this idea in the same way, in different ways. And so the image, I think, is helpful is seeing that these two characters, or these four characters, let's say, sort of drew from the same well, which was this well of tradition, and yet they expressed it in slightly different ways. So there's so much in common between Druidry and Wicca. I mean, you know, the three levels of initiation, the centrality of the circle, the magical circle, the importance of the directions, the calling up of the directions, and the celebration of the seasonal festivals, the Eightfold Wheel of the Year, the importance of the sun and the moon in the rituals, and the earth, of course. So very many similarities.
One thing about Wicca is I know that it pulled a lot from Freemasonry and Aleister Crowley. Is that where Wicca and Druidry kind of part, or does Druidry also incorporate some of those ideas?
Well, not the Aleister Crowley influence is found more in Wicca than in Druidry. Incidentally, Gerald Gardner was a Druid before Ross Nichols was a Druid. He was a member of the Ancient Druid Order, and then he invited my teacher, Ross Nichols, in, I think, the 1950s to join the Druid Order, which is kind of strange. The influence of Freemasonry has had an influence on Druidry. And part of the kind of work, I suppose, you know, I was chief of the order for 32 years. And during those sort of 30-odd years, it's kind of part of the work that I did really was, and it's quite, you have to be quite sensitive to this, is like sifting out what feels no longer appropriate. So a lot of that Freemasonic stuff feels kind of heavy and not really needed in this day and age. And so one of the things I did is slightly change things so there was less of a Masonic influence. But I think one of the most helpful ways to see the Western spiritual tradition, magical tradition in general, and you can also use the same kind of metaphor for Druidry and Wicca, is as a kind of river. And sometimes if I'm giving a workshop or something, I'll draw a kind of river on the board. And then you have all these tributaries. So you've got Freemasonry coming in. And as you know, I mean, medieval Christian magic was a strong influence on Wicca and, you know, and so on. And then it's all flowing out. And then the wonderful thing about our lives today is I think people are sufficiently kind of broad-minded today and educated to understand that they can develop a kind of practice that really suits them. They don't have to swallow everything hook, line, and sinker. The analogy is that I think, you know, Druidry certainly, and I think you can say this for Wicca as well, although, it'd be better if a Wiccan said this, but Druidry certainly is, you're in the kitchen, you're not in the restaurant. So you're not pitching up once a week and just taking the set menu. You're actually, you're in the kitchen and you've got the ingredients. You've got folklore, you've got tradition, you've got ritual practices, and a calendar, a sacred calendar. And then it's up to you to create good meals for you and your friends.
And can I be honest? I think that idea, in my opinion, is one of the most beautiful aspects of just spirituality, like folk spirituality, like the ability to really feel out what feels good and right and not having to stick to rules or, you know, like you said, the restaurant where you're just, shoving out the same thing over and over and over again, but being able to be creative and go with your heart. And I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
So what does, and like we just said, it kind of differs from person to person, but what does a druid practice look like? Like what maybe spiritually or magically, like what would that look like?
Yeah, okay. Because I think the interesting thing about Druidry and Wicca is that they are spiritual paths, but they're also magical paths. And this distinction is really important because there's a very useful model that's used in psychology, which is about whether you have an internal or an external locus of control. And what that means is if you have an external locus, i.e. sense of control, you feel as if your life, you're the victim of circumstance, if you like, that, you know, your life is the result of your genes, of politics, of the economics, of, you know, of other circumstances. If you if you have an internal locus of control, you still obviously know and understand that there are lots of external factors at play in your life, but you fundamentally believe that you're in charge of your life, and that it's up to you to sort of steer the ship. And that's one of the differences between perhaps the established religions or the Abrahamic religions and the magical religions, is that established religions can foster an external locus of control. You believe that it's happening out there, and that you have to worship and pray and so on, but your fate is determined by external forces. With a magical tradition, you are fully empowered, I think, to really work in the world, to be a force for good in the world, and to do things in the world. And so your question was it around what does druid practice look like, or?
Yeah, so like what the spirituality and the maybe like tangible practice looks like.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the cornerstones is the Eightfold Wheel of the Year, where every 6 weeks or so we engage in ritual or celebration, recognition of the particular time and moment that we're in the cycle of the year. So that's in reference to time. So what's happening there is we're building up a particular relationship with time, the dimension of time that we live in. But then there's also place, because essentially you can say that as humans, we live in time and in place, at the kind of intersection between time and place. And so we also work at developing our relationship with the land, with our locality, with where we live, with our home, you know, and so that home includes the body. So there's a particular relationship you have with your body, which again can be different from the established religions. And really loving the body, loving the instinctual life, the sensual life, and working to increase our sense of feeling at home in our bodies and where we live. And then also working to improve where we live. So, of course, a lot of druids are involved in environmental activism, where they work in their local community to on environmental projects.
Yeah, just recently, there's a lot of news right now about Stonehenge and the stuff kind of going on there, and people worried about roads being built that could disrupt like all that. So yeah, that's definitely something recent that we've seen a lot of, you know, druids kind of get involved in, like politically, and to save this really monumental place.
Saving monuments and saving trees as well. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned that I've never thought about, but the way you said it was just so wonderful, but the external versus internal locus of like control. And I've noticed when there are a lot of people who are maybe coming from, maybe they were raised in like an Abrahamic tradition or religion, and then they maybe come to a more nature-based spirituality, that is something they really, really struggle with. It's like a lot of the early questions are I saw these numbers, what do they mean for me? Or it's always these external things that they're so worried about, and kind of having to break through that idea of that does not have as much control as you think it does, and that you have more control than you realize. But I've never thought about it in the way you explained it, and that was really helpful.
Great, thank you. Yes, it's useful, because then you can also, you know, a kind of buzzword that people use at the moment is agency. I don't know if you've come across this agency. People talk about having agency and giving people agency and so on. And it really fosters people's sense of agency that they can be of, because, you know, it's very easy to look at the world as being so problematic. We can feel completely disempowered with the environmental crisis and the political crises we go through and so on. So I think if we can, part of the role of an earth-based tradition like Druidry or Wicca or witchcraft is to give people, help people find their agency and give them hope that they can be of value to the world in however small a way.
One question someone asked was, because Druidry does come from the Celts, which is, you know, like you said, now modern day Britain, Ireland, and Western France. Do you believe someone has to be of Celtic descent to be a Druid?
No. The couple of things to understand about that. One is that Celtic is not an ethnic definition. Many people misunderstand this. You can't do a blood test to find out whether you are Celtic. It's a cultural definition. It's about cultures. And people say, you know, one of the ways of understanding it is it's around language. And they say, you know, if you speak a Celtic language, then you are Celtic. This starts to get very interesting, because then you say, okay, what if you're in Wales and you meet a guy who was born in Nigeria, who was a refugee, say, and they ended up in Wales as a young person, and they learn Welsh and they speak Welsh fluently. Are they more Celtic, or are they Celtic compared to somebody who's born in Wales and who never learned Welsh, as most people in Wales aren't? They're not Welsh speakers. And then the definition starts to slip through your fingers like sand, and you realize that this is starting to get really unhelpful as a way of understanding it. So it's more helpful to see it like this, that spiritualities, spiritual traditions all have places where they were born. You know, Buddhism in India and so on, and, you know, Christianity in Palestine and so on. But they from there, they spread around the world. And they, because they speak the language of truth, essentially, and universal truth, they speak to everyone. And therefore, to suggest that only certain groups of people should have access to this would be really not a good idea at all.
I think something you said there that could really drive it home or clear it up for a lot of people is when you talked about, because almost everyone has some understanding of Christianity, even if you weren't raised Christian or no Christian. But I guess to say you can only be a Druid if you... derived from the Celts is, I guess, similar to say you can only be Christian if you are Palestinian. And yeah. I think that really should be the nail on the head right there.
Yes, that's right.
So speaking of misconceptions, is there any, as someone who is very well versed and who has been in this for a long time, is there like a common misconception that you see people think about Druidry that you are really ready to clear up?
Sure. Let's bust a few myths. Well, you know, one common misconception could be it's for men. It's a male thing, you know, and that's just not true. In our organization, we probably have slightly more women than men. What is true is that it attracts a lot of men. So often women will say to me, you know, oh, God, it's great to come to a Druid meeting because a lot of the kind of spiritual, particularly kind of more new agey perhaps stuff, tends to be dominated by women. There's a much higher proportion of women to men. Whereas in Druidry, it's a more even gender split, with trans people as well. And, you know, so that, but and historically, that's a myth that grew up out of the Freemasonic era from the sort of 18th century. You know, there's pictures that we're familiar with of white guys in beards wearing white robes, you know. And but, you know, if you look at the classical texts, they talk about women were druidesses, about how they shouted imprecations at the Roman soldiers who were trying to invade the Isle of Anglesey and so on. So it's not a male thing. The other misconception people have is that you have to wear white robes, and that's not true. You know, people choose to practice their Druidry in all sorts of ways, sky clad, wearing ordinary clothes, wearing different kind of clothes to everyday clothes or wearing robes. That's not an issue. What other myths are there? I think those are the two main ones, I think. Yeah, those are the two main ones.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like you said, photographs, honestly, photographs of a lot of different traditions really depict a lot of men, but I never considered it. It was because of the Freemasons. So that makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Yeah. So you've been in this for a long time. How has this spiritual path impacted your life?
Well, I mean, hugely. I mean, I met the old chief druid. I was really lucky. I met the old chief druid when I was 11. And I came across Buddhism and Druidism at the same time. I read a book when I was 11 called The Life of the Buddha, which was a very lyrical, poetic book. And I decided at that time that this was the only game in town, which was gaining enlightenment. I mean, you read that book and you thought, why would anybody focus on anything other than, you know, what the Buddha focused on, which was gaining enlightenment? And then I met the chief druid at the same time, and he was a family friend. So he was like a kind of uncle figure who was kind of there in our lives. And then when I was 16, I asked if I could train with him. And but I still retain my interest in Buddhism, which I still do, and have an interest in Eastern religions. And I've forgotten what your question is. It's just suddenly got out of my mind.
I asked the impact it's had on your life.
Oh, the impact has on me. Yeah. Okay. So you know, it started to impact me really young, and it's been a theme. And then I was asked to lead the order in my 30s. You know, so. And then over the last, 30 years or so, I've seen this tremendous growth of interest in it. And, for 20 years, we still have Druid camps, but I was involved in them for 20 years. So both of our daughters went through Druid camps. And so they've, I've seen their lives impacted by it. We have friends all over the world now. I mean, it's just incredible, We could go on an extended tour around the world just staying with Druid friends, and the kind of people that we've met have been incredible. Musicians, artists, poets, all sorts of. My colleague who's taken over from me, Ema Burke, who's now the chief of the order in Ireland, every week she interviews a member of the order on a thing called Fireside Chat with Ema, and she talks to ordinary members, and of course what you discover is no member is ordinary. They're all extraordinary. They've got incredible stories to tell, incredible life experiences, incredible insights. So my life has been made immeasurably richer by connecting with Druidry, I have to say.
So I only have one more question, and it's going to be a really hard one.
Yeah.
So what would you say is maybe like one life lesson that you've learned throughout your spiritual life that you think could be beneficial to somebody listening?
A life lesson that I've learned from my spiritual life that could be helpful to people. Okay. Like all these things, I think, they sound so simple because I think, life in some sense is incredibly varied and complex at one level. But at another level, there's a beautiful kind of simplicity to life. And a kind of principle that I live with really and have for years is I would sum up as relaxing into trust. And by relaxing, I mean literally relaxing physically with my muscles. So what happens as you go through the day, you kind of tense up because you're having to focus and concentrate and look at screens and deal with problems and deal with issues. And that requires focus and And it requires muscular tension, because otherwise you just flop on the ground. You wouldn't be able to do it. So, but there's a way in which, you know, what I do is just every so often I will just close my eyes and I will literally relax the tension that I can feel in my body, you know, and drop into a place, a state of consciousness that I would sum up as trust, which is, and it's trust and it's love. And it, so it's just, it's a place where however difficult life may seem, whatever the challenge I happen to be facing at the time, there's this kind of bedrock belief, faith, knowledge, understanding that I have, an experience that I have, that life is benign. You know, people talk about pronoia as opposed to paranoia. You know, that life is conspiring to do me good. And if I can just relax into trust, things will work out, you know. And that doesn't mean that I have to be accepting of everything. It doesn't mean that I have to be gullible and naive and, oh, just trust this man who sent me an email asking me to transfer money into his account, or, you know, a scam email. You know, trusting is not trusting. It's not trusting in that sense. You know, it's something really deep inside. And it's, I know that it's hard to do that, particularly if you've had traumatic or difficult events, if you've had a difficult childhood, for instance, where the parental figures, you couldn't trust them, where you suffered at the hands of them. I understand that it can be really hard. And I think part of a spirituality's remit or goal is to help you relax into trust. It's, you know, and part of a spiritual search is about where do I go that I feel I can do this? You know, if I go into a church and sit in this church service, is the minister there and the atmosphere and the congregation, is that allowing me to find this sense of trust and that I can completely let go into this sense of, is it in a Druid circle? Is it in a Wicca circle? Is it, you know, where is it? You know. So where can people find me? My name, without the hyphen, so philipcargom.com. So it's one L for Philip, and, you know, and then there's, and that's my stuff. I do sort of online courses and trainings and things like that. There's also druidry.org. That's druidry.org. And that's all our Druid programs on there.
Awesome. So we'll have that in the podcast episode description so people can easily find it.
Great.
Witches, we hope that you have an amazing day filled with magic and inspiration. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to our Patreon. Need a support system? Find The Witch Daily Show on Facebook and our website, witchdailyshow.com.